the other side. They found a front window, haphazardly covered with boards, and peered out between the cracks to find a street just as dark and empty as the one behind them. The window still had glass, which would be too loud to break, so they looked for another way out. The front door was sealed with a heavy link chain on the outside, and when they tried to open it, slowly, quietly, barely daring to breathe, they found that it would only pull in a few inches before the chain stopped it.
"Not far enough," said Lisa. "Maybe the windows on the upper floors are open."
"Go look,"
said Reed.
"I'm going to try to find tools."
He was nearly blind in the darkness, but started in the kitchen while Lisa went upstairs. He opened each drawer carefully, probing delicately in case any of them held knives. The object scraped loudly across the wood as he sifted through them, and he was certain that someone outside would hear and come looking. He found the junk drawer with an old screwdriver just as Lisa came back downstairs, shaking her head.
"They were thorough. Every window is nailed shut."
She pointed at the screwdriver in Reed's hand.
"That's not going to help."
"This is for the door," he said, and led her back to the front. The chain would stop anyone trying to get in, but only because the people outside couldn't reach the hinges. On the inside, they were perfectly accessible. He worked the flat head of the screwdriver under the pin in the bottom hinge and slowly levered it up and out. The pin was nearly 4 inches long and scraped through the metal rings that held it in place. He had to remind himself that it only seemed loud because he was nervous. He hoped he wasn't lying to himself. He started on the second hinge. It scraped out more slowly than the first, and Reed wished he could see through the door. He imagined a pair of East German soldiers simply standing on the other side, listening to their clumsy fumbling with amused smiles, ready to arrest them both as soon as the door opened. He finished pulling the pin out of the second hinge and started working on the third. Lisa seemed to be thinking the same thoughts, for she had taken out her Walther P-38 pistol. When the last pin finally slid free, she licked her lips and pointed the gun at the doorway, bracing herself for whatever was on the other side. Reed moved the door slowly, pulling it loose from the hinges to pivot on the chain. He opened it just wide enough for Lisa to peer out. Lisa looked, then nodded.
"Alles klar."
She stowed her pistol in the pocket of her coat, and together they slipped outside, reached back in, and propped the door as well as they could in the doorway. They were in East Berlin. Their abandoned house had also technically been in East Berlin, but it had felt like more of a no man's land, cut off from either side. Even the ghost stations were a gray area, tolerated by both sides, but belonging to neither. This, though, was real, visually identical to the city they'd just left, but somehow, impossibly, a million miles away. The street in front was more of an alley, a kind of walkway between this row of houses and another that didn't touch the border and thus hadn't been evacuated. They crept silently through the darkness, skirting the edges of dim, glowing circles where light pooled outward from curtained windows. When they reached the street, Lisa took Reed's arm, holding it familiarly like lovers out on a date, and the simplicity of the action twisted at his heart. In West Berlin, wary of being seen, they had rarely ever walked so closely or so casually together. Only here, in enemy territory, could they be themselves in public. The more they walked, the more the shocking sameness of East Berlin chafed at his senses. It was enemy territory, perhaps, but only because his enemies were the people who ruled it. The Stasi, the Grenzers, the Soviet Union, and those GDR officials who went along with their commands, either because it helped them personally or because they saw no way to resist. Everyone else who lived here, the fathers and mothers, the children, the butchers and bakers and brewers and shopkeepers, they were just normal people.
as German as anyone on the other side of the wall, barely 50 feet away. The wall wasn't even 3 months old, and before that, this had been one city. Four sectors with stricter and stricter rules every year, but still one city. Reed had always thought of the people trapped on the eastern side as prisoners, straining under an oppressive regime, but walking among them now shattered every illusion he had ever held.
Voices drifted down from open windows. Cars drove in the distance. Couples dressed almost identically to him and Lisa walked quietly down each street, holding hands or talking. People laughed. Televisions droned. A cat sat on the rim of a high wooden fence and watched them go by. Lisa guided him subtly, passing from smaller streets to larger until they reached the thoroughfare of Torstrasse. They were practically downtown now, and while the city was quiet, it wasn't asleep. People laughed in cafes or sang in bars, and cars filled the streets with light. They stood on a curb and hailed a cab, and Reed let Lisa do the talking.
Devisen Sie bitte?
Ja,
said the driver, and took them back out into traffic, deeper and deeper into the GDR. Lisa slipped Reed some of the East German marks, and when they reached the park, he smiled and paid and helped Lisa chivalrously from the car. He worried about his accent, but he'd lived in Berlin for years and practiced the language daily, and the taxi driver didn't bat an eye. They stood on an asphalt walkway that ringed the park and watched as the cab drove away.
You speak well, said Lisa.
Danke, said Reed.
She took his arm again, leaned close, and kissed him.
Is that for luck? He asked. Or for courage?
For both. And for anyone watching two people go walking into an unlit park in the middle of the night.
Reed nodded and let her lead him into the trees. It was just past 11. The Weisensee was a narrow ring of trees around a small dark lake, flat and black but glittering in the faint starlight. Lisa led him left, past a shuttered food stand, along a narrow path that skirted the edge of the water. A tiny jetty reached out into the lake, lined with rowboats carefully chained to metal rings. They walked slowly, as if Lisa was remembering the area piece by piece, getting her bearings after years of being away. They walked farther, past a locked restaurant and tiny junctions with other paths. At one point, Lisa paused, frowned, and led them backward, finding one of the junctions and taking a different direction. Eventually, they reached a row of benches, looking out through the trees at what Reed assumed would be a picturesque view of the lake during the daytime. At night, it was dark and isolated, lit only by a waning moon. Reed felt lost and exposed at once.
Lass uns sitzen, said Lisa, not loudly but cheerfully, still keeping up the pretense that they were simply lovers on a date.
She cuddled close to him and kissed him again, and when her lips pressed up against his cheek, she whispered softly in his ear,
I don't think we've been followed. Let's wait a moment and see.
She kissed him again, though he found that any thrill he may have gotten from it was deadened by his anxious nerves and by the disconcerting theory that she was only kissing him as part of an op. That Lisa wasn't kissing Wallace Reed. It was only her nebulous cover identity, kissing whatever passed for his. He wondered all over again how real their relationship had ever really been.
A minute passed, and then another, and soon she nodded.
We're alone.
She set her purse on the ground by her feet, and then, on the pretense of retrieving it, she reached under the bench, probed gently with her fingers, and sat back up. She was clutching something tightly, and Reed saw a triumphant smile on her face.
Dietrich, she said giddily, you son of a bitch.
Did you find it?
She turned her hand over and opened her fingers, and there in her palm was a tiny metal canister, no bigger than a cigarette. She picked it up and pulled on one end, and the tip slid off like a tiny metal cap. She set the cap aside, tipped the cylinder into her hand,
and a tiny roll of paper fell out. Her whisper was practically reverent. Message 41.
11:15 p.m. East Berlin.
We have some time, Wally, said Lisa. Decode it here, and then we will both know what it says. If something goes wrong on our way back, we'll have twice the chance that one of us will be able to deliver it.
Reed plucked the paper from her hand and carefully unrolled it. The moon had been full only a few days before, so the message was difficult to read, but not impossible. It was a string of numbers carefully written by hand in a firm black pen. Reed counted exactly 23 numbers. This was definitely the missing message. Gnawed through the insulation, he thought, remembering the appropriate section of player piano. He began the translation, found that the first letter was B, and stopped in worry.
This isn't right, he said. The confirmation code that day was V. The first letter should be V.
Maybe he didn't use the confirmation code, said Lisa. Try a few more letters.
Reed decoded the second letter, R. The third letter worked out to Q, the fourth and fifth to V and L.
This is all wrong, said Reed. It's gibberish.
He laughed at the absurdity of it.
We finally find the real message 41, and it's just more gibberish.
Maybe you're decoding it wrong. I know what I'm doing. That's not what I mean, said Lisa.
You're the only one who knows the Longshore codes, you and Davis. But Dietrich is not expecting you or Davis to be here. He sent these messages to me specifically, and he's expecting me to be the one to decode it.
Reed frowned.
Okay, but then why skip 23 letters from the one-time pad if he isn't actually using them?
He knew the answer as soon as he said it out loud and shook his head at his own foolishness.
Because that's the only way to let us know there was a missing message. He skipped the letters to get us all looking, but he can encode this in whatever method he knows you can decipher.
And you don't know about the code I use. He looked at Lisa.
So? What encryption systems did you use when you worked with him?
Nothing fancy, said Lisa. Our messages were small and usually not vital enough for extensive encryption. We used English, and then sometimes Rot 13.
Reed almost winced.
Please don't tell me that the safety of the free world was being protected by Rot 13.
I told you our messages weren't usually vital. Meeting times in public cafes, that sort of thing, and then anything important we said in person. Rot 13 was perfect because even if we were caught, we wouldn't look like spies using BND codes, but like college kids asking each other on dates in silly ways.
I guess that makes sense, said Reed, but it still bothered him.
Rot 13 was one of the most well-known ciphers in the world. It stood for Rotate the alphabet 13 places, so all you did was take A equals 1 and move it to A equals 14. If anything, Rot 13 was even less secure than A equals 1. If you turned them into letters instead of numbers, the first half of the alphabet mapped perfectly onto the second, and vice versa, so the encryption and the decryption methods were identical. A equals N and N equals A. It was fun for hobbyists, but dangerously insecure for anything else.
The first number of the message was 9. The Rot 13 for 9 was V. The confirmation code was correct. Reed closed his eyes.
I can't believe the hidden message we bent our entire lives around is in Rot 13.
Just decode it, said Lisa.
Reed scratched out the other letters with his pen and started over.
V-R-E-E. Damn, he said, seeing where this was headed.
He swallowed and wrote the fifth letter next to the others. D.
R-E-E-E. D. Your name,
Lisa whispered.
I know, said Reed. His heart was racing. Why was his name in this message?
I'm not a double agent. Of course you're not a double agent, said Lisa,
though he could hear the fluster in her voice. We only assumed this message was about a double agent. It could be anything. He could be telling us you're in danger.
Then dragging me into the heart of the GDR is a bad way to tell me.
He had no idea you would be here, said Lisa.
Just finish it. It might not even be your name once we see the rest of the letters.
Reed nodded and continued the translation. I-S-N-T.
Thank goodness.
He breathed. He hoped that isn't was a good thing.
Hurry, said Lisa. B-A-K-E-R.
Reed isn't Baker, said Lisa.
Why hide this? If he knows who Baker is, why not just tell us straight out?
Because he doesn't know who Baker is, said Reed. He told us as much in his other messages.
This made him frown.
There was only one reason it would be necessary to say now and in this message that Reed wasn't a specific Stasi agent.
To differentiate him from another Stasi agent.
He didn't want to keep going, but he was in it now. Sit down, grab the rail, and hope the train didn't crash.
He decoded the next letter, A, and the next letter, L, then R-E-A-D-Y.
Already? He wondered. Already what?
Lisa wasn't speaking. She was barely even breathing.
Does she see the same possibility I'm seeing? He thought. Where this looks like it's going? But it can't possibly be true.
There were only three letters left, and as soon as he decoded the first, he knew what the rest would be.
M. He licked his lips. This is wrong, he said.
Wally,
said Lisa softly. Finish the code.
M. F. S. The Stasi. Reed isn't Baker, already MFS.
Barely a second after he wrote it down, Lisa was standing up, backing away from him, the pistol in her hand glinting dully in the moonlight through the trees, a Valter P-38 with a suppressor attached.
Drop the pad and paper.
It's not true, said Reed.
Drop them!
Lisa.
You know it's not true.
Just drop them, she barked.
And Reed let the pad and paper fall to the ground, raising his hands above his head.
Take off your coat.
Can we talk about this? You have a gun in your coat pocket, she said. And a hammer, I think, because I did not see you leave it at the wall.
So yes, we're going to talk. But first, you are going to take off that coat and leave those weapons out of reach before we say anything.
Reed nodded, slowly trying to figure out what he could do or say.
If I set down my gun, you have to set down yours.
That's not how this works. He was innocent. He knew he was innocent, and she had to know it too. She was just being cautious. If he could talk to her, surely she'd understand. He started to stand, but she stopped him immediately.
Nine. Stay in your seat. Keep your hands above your head and pull your sleeves off one at a time.
Reed complied, slowly and without any threatening movements. The October air was cold and he shivered as first one sleeve came off and then the other.
Why would I translate that message in that way if I were a Stasi agent?
He dropped the second sleeve and the coat fell limply on the bench behind him.
I don't know, said Lisa. Now stand up and take 10 steps over there to the middle of the path.
He stood and stepped slowly away from the coat and the weapons. She rotated with him, maintaining a careful distance, always out of reach, always with her pistol trained squarely on his torso. She reached his coat, rifled through the folds, and slipped the gun from his pocket to hers. The hammer came next, disappearing into another pocket of her coat.
Tell me what this means, Lisa said.
It means Longshore is wrong.
Prove it.
You know me, said Reed. You know that I'm not a traitor or a double agent. I know that you never seemed like one. Do I seem like one now?
No. She paused, watching him shiver in the cold, and then shook her head.
No, you don't. But I can't ignore this.
Somehow Longshore is wrong, said Reed.
We can find an explanation.
Not together, said Lisa. You need to understand. We're in enemy territory with no backup and no resources, no way of proving anything, so either I let my guard down, making myself vulnerable to a man our most trusted asset thinks is a traitor, or I find another way. You have to know that I can't let my guard down, right?
She sounded desperate.
You have to understand that.
But I'm not a traitor.
But you have to know that I can't ignore this, right?
She was pleading with him now.
You have to.
You keep saying that.
It's true.
It's my word against his, said Reed.
Do you really trust him more than me?
If I trust you and I'm wrong, I die.
Reed choked back a shout, composed himself, and spoke.
So you're going to let me die instead?
She stared at him in silence, and he saw the glint of tears on her cheeks.
I don't want to,
she said at last.
Then don't.
Then what? What do you want? What do you expect me to do? I'm not a double agent! How can I possibly know that?
Her voice was trembling.
You insisted on coming here with me, against all logic, against all of your alleged expertise.
Is that because you knew what it would say? You knew that you couldn't let me read this message alone, so you came here to kill me and take a different message back to the cabin? If that was my plan, I'm doing a pretty bad job of it.
Yes, you are. So why? He demanded. If I really had some grand plan to overpower you, why didn't I do it?
Because you never respected me, she said.
And there was more pain in those words than in anything she'd said to that point.
I was a field agent for years. I infiltrated Stasi buildings. I passed secrets over the most tightly controlled border in the world. One time, I wrestled a KGB operative for 10 minutes until I finally choked him unconscious. I am a decorated professional, Wally. And you have always treated me like a frail little girl who doesn't know what she's doing.
Reed trailed off, shattered, and realized it was true.
I'm sorry.
You thought you could get here. If this is true, I mean, you thought you could bring me here and gloat over the message and defeat me like that. She snapped her fingers.
Does that really sound like me? I'm a cryptographer, Lisa. I'm a mathematician who likes puzzles. I'm a terrible intelligence officer and useless as a spy, and you know that. You know me. I didn't think you were weak because you're a woman or because I'm arrogant or anything else. I just assumed you couldn't do things because I couldn't do them. Because I'm weak.
He paused.
Lisa, what's more likely? That I'm a Stasi mastermind? Or that I'm a bookworm in over his head?
The bookworm, she said instantly. By a mile. She shook her head.
I want to believe you, but you have to understand that I cannot. Not here.
You keep saying that, not until I'm safe. She paused, swallowing, and kept the gun trained on his chest, and when she spoke again, her voice was harsh.
Maybe I am just a silly little girl, too stupid to see past your awkward mumbles and your friendly manners and your cryptographer face.
She spat the last two words like they were poison, like they were good friends she'd trusted and then they'd betrayed her.
"Just put down the gun," said Reed. "Look at this from my side," said Lisa. "You might be innocent, you probably are. The only suspicious things you have ever done in your entire life are the ones I talked you into, but now there's a note."
Her voice broke again.
"Now there is an accusation, and even if it is false, I cannot ignore it. You have to see that right if it's true. You'll kill me the first chance you get, or you'll leave me alive and I'll take you back to the cabin where every officer there and half the U.S. State Department are searching for this message and the double agent it reveals, and what? We tell them we found it and it says the traitor is you, but you said you were innocent and I just believed you? No one would ever trust me again. Or worse, we don't tell anyone, and no one ever finds the message. And then a year or a month or even just a week later, when I'm fully and completely guilty of hiding a potential double agent, you tell me that it is true, every word of it, and threaten to blackmail me if I don't help you pass secrets to the Stasi. And then, like before, no one ever trusts me again. And they will be right not to. She shook her head. I am in this too deep already. Wally, the lies and the spying on Davis and now stealing from his safe, we sneaked across the wall. And even if we had not done any of those things, even if we had sat back and let all of this pass us by, we've still been hiding an illegal relationship from the CIA and the BND. For months. The one and only way we could ever recover from any of this is if that piece of paper had someone else's name on it. Any name at all. We could take it back, expose the traitor, and be heroes.
She was sobbing more openly now.
But it's your name. And true or not, that name has destroyed us.
You could take me in as a prisoner, said Reed. They'll lock me up for a while, but they won't find anything. And we'll both be exonerated. How could I possibly take you back as a prisoner?
Asked Lisa, exasperated.
Think this through, Wally. If you really are a traitor, you'll take the first opportunity to attack me. So I need to either keep this gun on you or knock you unconscious. Do you think that in either of those scenarios, we can just stroll out of this park, hail another taxi, and flee the wrong direction across the wall?
I won't attack you, Lisa shook her head. I have learned two things in my life. First, anyone who spends his energy telling you he is trustworthy is not.
Second, when an enemy goes out of his way to show you how weak he is, that's the one you kill first.
You don't...
Reed felt his knees start to weaken.
You don't have to kill me, but I can't let you follow me. If you are part of the Stasi, I can't let you warn them I'm trying to cross the wall.
You're going to leave me here?
What other choice do I have?
She reached up with a free hand and wiped the tears from her face.
If you are guilty, then the fate of the free world rests on my shoulders to stop you, even if you are innocent. I can't take the risk of letting you go. But if you are innocent, Wally, if you really are innocent, please lay low. We will find a way to prove it and bring you home.
Reed took a step toward her, but she stopped him cold with a gesture of her pistol.
I know it's hard. If my name was on that message, you would do the same to me.
He
hesitated again.
No, I wouldn't.
And then he said out loud what he'd never dared to say before.
I love you.
Lisa stared at him for a moment, drawn out into an eternity in the dark, empty silence of the park. He stared back. She angled the gun down and shot him in the foot. Even suppressed, the noise of it exploded through the empty park, and Reed fell to the ground with a grunt, clutching his foot while a cacophony of pain screamed through his skull. "People will be coming to investigate the shot," she said. "Get out of here, try not to leave a blood trail, and lay low. If you are innocent, we'll get you out." Reed tried to answer, but all he could manage was her name, screamed out in heartbreak and betrayal.
"Lisa!"
She turned away and disappeared into the night. Friday, October 27th, 1961, 12:03 a.m., East Berlin. Reed gritted his teeth against the pain, trying to concentrate. He needed to. Something. Pain. His foot was all he could think about. Bolts of pain stabbed up through his leg and into his thighs and back, and he found himself writhing in the dirt of the path.
"No," he thought. "I have to what? I have to move. People are coming. I have to get out of here."
He bit down hard, clenching his teeth together. He was lying in the dirt, partially smeared with it. His right foot was bleeding, a red tide pooling out through the bullet holes in his shoes, mostly on the bottom, but even the hole in the top was oozing red. He needed to wrap it. With what? His coat. His heavy wool coat was still draped on the bench, a black hole in the darkness of the park. He dragged himself toward it, using one hand and his one good foot, keeping his left hand clamped tight on the wound to try to staunch the flow of blood. He dragged the coat down to the ground. It was a trench coat, calf length, with a tie for the waist. He wrapped his foot in the folds of it around and around and used the tie and his own leather belt to cinch it down hard. It would stop most of the bleeding for now. He could do better when he got clear of the danger. Reed paused, clenching his fists to distract himself from the pain, and tried to listen. Were those voices? How close were they? The gunshot wouldn't go unnoticed. People would come. He needed to hide, but he didn't know where. Which way was the road? He'd gotten so turned around by the message and the argument with Lisa and the pain. Did she really think he was a Stasi agent? Had she really shot him? There was no time to dwell on it now. He had to move. He grabbed the bench and heaved himself to his feet, putting all of his weight on his left leg. The leg was behind him during their walk to the bench. It had been on their right. If he kept it on his left, he would be walking back to the main road, and he didn't want that. He had no money for a taxi. His foot was a giant ball of wool, and his hands and arms were covered with blood. He needed to stay hidden. He kept the leg on his right side and started hobbling along the path, deeper into the park. Every step was agony. His foot felt like it was on fire, and any pressure, on or off, sent spikes of excruciating pain rocketing up his legs. He clenched every muscle in his upper body, not just his hands, but his arms and his elbows and his shoulders, tightening his chest and flexing his jaw, using the exertion as a distraction from the pain in his foot. He passed the first tree, then the second, then the third. He could definitely hear voices now, off to the left. He glanced down and behind himself, looking for the telltale glimmer of blood on the path, but there was nothing. The layers of his coat were stopping it for now. He kept walking. A fourth tree, a fifth. All he wanted to do was lie down. They couldn't find him if he lay down, right? But of course they could. He was wearing a white dress shirt. He practically glowed in the dark. And once the police found blood, they'd bring dogs. And then it wouldn't matter what color he was wearing. He had to get far away, and he had to move faster than whoever was looking for him. He needed a car. Streetlights ahead of him beckoned him onward.
He was nearing the far side of the park, or at least he could see it now. The park seemed to go on forever, but he knew that was probably just an illusion brought on by the pain and the slow speed of travel. Where could he get a car? Could he risk just introducing himself to someone? "Hi, I'm an American intelligence officer on a secret mission. I need you to hide me." East Berlin was full of Western sympathizers, but what were the odds he could find one, and on his first try? Even one GDR loyalist or one fence-sitter too frightened to defy the Stasi, and Reed would find himself arrested before he could do anything about it. Could he steal a car instead? Could he even drive one? The bandage on his right leg would make the pedals almost impossible to use, let alone the wound itself. The path reached a clearing, the lake on his left, and a wide lawn with an empty parking lot on his right. He set out across the grass, keeping to the trees as best he could, and skirted the open area with low, agonizing steps. He passed another restaurant on his right, closed and empty for the night, and then a dark house on his left. He was nearly at the edge of the park. The road here was lined with parked cars, and he started trying the handles of each one, hoping to find one open. Some of them were, but none had keys in them. He was out of the park completely now, walking between two apartment buildings. Some windows had lights, but most were dark. He paused, leaning against a wall to take pressure off his foot. A car drove past on the road ahead, and Reed pressed himself more fully against the wall, trying to blend in and disappear. The road was empty again, and Reed dragged himself along the wall, hopping on his good foot. None of the cars would work. How close were the pursuers behind him? He looked back, but didn't see anyone. Had he gotten away? He heard dogs baying in the distance. He didn't know if they were police dogs or not, and didn't want to risk finding out. He crossed the street to another tall building, though this one was clearly not an apartment and didn't look like an office building. He hobbled to the nearest window, peered in, and saw rows of desks. It was a school, probably a high school by the size of it. That gave him an idea, and he clenched his teeth against the pane and hopped around the periphery of the building, looking for the main entrance. He found it, and sure enough, it had a bike rack nearby with a pair of forgotten bicycles. One of them was unchained. Reed said a quick prayer of gratitude, newly convinced that God might be real, and pulled the bike out onto the sidewalk. He threw his bad leg over the seat, took a deep breath, and launched himself forward. He whimpered as he pressed down on his right foot, trying to use the thick wrapping of his makeshift bandage to work the pedals, and rolled away into the night. He didn't know where he was going. His first priority was to get away from the scene of the shooting and deal with his other problems when he had more time. He coasted through empty side streets, putting distance between himself and the park, and cataloged those problems now. For starters, he was bleeding to death. The bandage on his foot was keeping his blood off the ground, but he suspected it was doing very little to keep that blood inside of his body. Increasing lightheadedness and woozy sensations only added to that fear. He needed to find a pharmacy soon, or at the least, any collection of fabric he could use to bind his wound more tightly. A clothing store might be better than a pharmacy, he decided, because his other immediate problem was his shirt, with its sleeves stained from blood. They would make him stand out far too easily anywhere he went. And that was the biggest problem, wasn't it? Where to go? He needed to cross the wall. Assuming he could even make it to the abandoned homes on Bernauerstrasse, was that route still open? It was hard enough to believe that one agent could make it back through the way they came in, let alone two, let alone with one of them injured. How then? The Berlin Wall was, as Lisa had said, the most closely watched, tightly controlled border in the world. Werner Probst and dozens like him had been shot for even trying to cross it. Reed couldn't just stroll up and do it, and he certainly couldn't do it alone. But who could he turn to? The only contact he had in the GDR was Longshore,
and Longshore apparently thought Reed was a Stasi agent. He reached a row of darkened storefronts and slowed his bike to peer into them. A bakery, a grocery store, a bookshop, another bakery. He turned a careful arc in the road and rolled down the other side of the street. An electronics shop, a real estate agent, a sewing shop. He stopped at this one, leaning on his good leg. The window was full of mannequins, but behind them he could see walls lined with shelves, all of them filled with bolts of fabric. It would be perfect, but how could he get in? As was common in Germany, the stores were the bottom floor of a much larger building, and the upper floors were almost certainly homes and apartments. Breaking the window would make noise and attract attention. He kept his bad leg draped over the bike and hopped alongside it around the building, looking for another way in. An alley led to the building's rear, where a couple of cars shared the narrow space with a series of garbage cans. He heard music drifting down from an open window above, probably a record player. He heard no voices, but stayed as silent as possible just in case. He counted the back doors, trying to calculate which would be the rear entrance to the sewing shop. He made his best guess, leaned the bike against the wall, and studied the small glass window in the door. Would anyone track him this far? Would some enterprising police detective connect the shooting in Weisensee Park to the mysterious thefts of a bicycle and some fabric? Would they connect any of it to a rogue CIA officer abandoned on the wrong side of the wall? He was running out of time and couldn't waste any more of it on theories and extrapolations. He leaned his back against the window, dampening the sound with his body, and slammed his elbow into the thin pane of glass. It shattered, and Reed held his breath, listening for a response. No one seemed to have noticed. He reached his hand through the broken window, turned the knob, and let himself in. In addition to the main store area, the shop included a storage room, a tiny restroom, and a small back room, more of a break room than an office. This had a woman's jacket hanging on a wooden coat rack, and he put it on gratefully. He grabbed a bolt of thick cotton, a pair of heavy scissors, and a small cushion bristling with pins, and went into the restroom. It was barely more than a toilet and a sink, though the floor was tiled, and the wall had a spigot that they probably used for mopping. He took a long, ravenous drink from the sink, then collapsed on the toilet and allowed himself a single luxurious minute to rest. It was one of the greatest sensations he had ever felt. Even with the jacket on, he was shivering from cold and from loss of blood, and something in the back of his mind told him to just give up. To stay here, relatively warm and no longer running, and just let whatever happened happen. He listened to that voice longer and more intently than he should have, practically in tears at the pain and exhaustion he was feeling, both physical and emotional. "Just wait," he told himself. "Stop running and just wait." No. With more effort than he cared to admit, he forced himself to lean forward and undo the belts that held the coat to his foot. The wool coat loosened and he unwrapped it slowly. The inner layers were soaked with blood, and he let the coat fall in a dark, pungent pile in the corner. Next came his shoe, and he groaned in agony as he loosened the laces and then pulled the thing free of his foot. The side of his foot and the hole through the middle of it almost made him pass out. He dropped his head between his knees and took deep breaths. When he thought he could move again, he started unrolling cotton sheeting from the bolt. He took about 2 yards and then got to work cutting it into strips of bandage with the scissors. He wanted to wash the wound, but worried that the pain of it would be too strong. More than that, though, he was simply bleeding too much to let the wound go unwrapped even 1 second longer. He shoved a wadded bandage into the hole, gritting his teeth at the pain that burned through him at the touch, and then began winding more bandages around his foot, stretching them as tightly as he could.
When he finished, he secured the bandage carefully with pins from the cushion and then collapsed back onto the toilet again. Two problems dealt with, and if he kept the jacket he was wearing, that made three. Now he just needed somewhere to go, as he doubted the shop's owners would take kindly to him breaking in and stealing their things. He wished he had something to repay them with, but he'd left everything of value in his apartment. But where could he go? Who in the vast city of East Berlin would take in an American spy? He didn't know anybody here. Wait. He hauled himself to his feet and limped back to the front of the store. He'd seen a phone behind the counter, which meant that there might be, yes, a phone book. He set it on the counter and flipped to the R's. He didn't know anybody here, but Lisa did. Her old contact, Pollard Rapp. He found the address and looked it up on the map in the back of the book. 3 miles away, not easy to get to by any means, but not impossible either. He tore the map from the phone book and hobbled outside to the bike. 2:21 a.m. East Berlin. Pollard Rapp lived in a squat gray house on a street called Mittelstieg. It was a quiet neighborhood full of houses instead of apartments, each with a small yard and tall pine trees. It was probably a peaceful neighborhood, Reed thought, but he was too exhausted and too terrified to feel anything but dread. Every tree seemed to loom over him like a phantom. Every home seemed to house Stasi surveillance and KGB informers. Reed found Rapp's house, read the number twice to be sure he'd gotten it right, and pulled his bike behind the small car that sat in the narrow driveway. He dragged himself to the door, driven more by desperation than any actual remaining strength, and rang the bell. A moment passed in silence, and he rang it again, 3 times to be sure the old man could hear it. Reed watched the other houses nervously in the shadows and the formless silhouettes, certain at any moment he could see police and soldiers pouring out of the darkness to arrest him. He rang the bell, and then he rang it again, and then again and again and again, horrified that the neighbors would hear it and come looking, but too horrified to stop. Finally, he heard footsteps behind the door and shouted curses.
Drecksau!
The door opened and an old man stood in the entryway, wearing a robe and slippers and scowling in a fury.
Verflucht nochmal! Das ist halb drei am Morgen? Wer bist du?
Please, said Reed. He clutched the railing for strength.
Ich brauche...
He couldn't remember his German and switched to English, though he felt like he could barely remember that either.
I need your help. Medicine.
Gott in Himmel, whispered Pollard. He stared for a moment, then started to close the door, but Reed shuffled forward, trying to keep it open with his hand.
Please,
he said.
I'm a friend of Lisa Kohler.
Even if it wasn't true anymore, he took a ragged breath and zipped open the stolen jacket to show the man the bloodstains underneath.
Please.
Pollard looked at him a moment longer, then took Reed by the arm and pulled him inside. He took one last careful look at the empty street outside, then closed and locked the door and led Reed to a couch. Sit here.
What medicine?
He pointed at Reed's foot.
You are hurt?
Reed collapsed on the couch, closing his eyes in relief.
Shot. I was on a mission with Lisa. It went bad.
Wait here, said Pollard, and Reed heard the floor creak as the man went to get something. The next thing he knew, sunlight was peeking through the curtains.
Guten Morgen,
said Pollard. Reed opened his eyes. He was lying on the old man's couch in a tiny living room, rimmed with knickknacks and photos. He tried to sit up, but the motion made him woozy, and he sank back down.
Son,
he said. His throat felt raw.
What time is it?
A quarter for eight, said Pollard. I gave you drugs and cleaned your foot.
Eight, said Reed, grimacing. I've slept for hours.
Not long enough, said Pollard. You need rest.
I need.
Reed trailed off. He didn't know what he needed. Reed raised his head just enough to look down at his legs. His foot was wrapped in a different bandage. The wraps had frayed edges and a hint of a faded floral pattern. Probably old sheets. He moved it gingerly and found that while it still throbbed, the strident fury of the pain was dulled.
You cleaned it?
It is not good to leave a wound dirty.
Reed laid his head back down on the couch and closed his eyes in amazement.
I don't know how I slept through that, but thank you.
I have issues, said Pollard, reaching his hand to point at his own back. I do not know the English word. Back pain, he smiled. I have good pills.
Reed nodded.
You saved my life.
Maybe.
The old man shrugged.
You are still in East Berlin.
He glanced at the window, though the curtains made it impossible to see outside.
I know this must be dangerous for you, said Reed. Risking yourself for me like this. I want you to know that I'm incredibly grateful. I don't know how or even when I'll be able to repay you.
We have always done what we can for Germany, said Pollard, and looked at one of the photos hanging nearby on the wall, a younger Pollard with a woman and a son.
He stared at it a moment, then looked back at Reed.
You are not supposed to be here.
I am not. I was on a secret mission, I guess. I'm a spy for the West.
And you know Lisa Kohler?
She was my partner, sort of.
Reed frowned and tried to weave a better-sounding version of the truth, or at least a more confident one.
Not permanent partners, but last night we were. She used to talk about you sometimes, so when we got separated, I came here.
The look of concern clouded Pollard's face. Is she shut too?
Not as far as I know, said Reed. When she left me, she was fine. I assume she got back over the border again, but I don't know for sure.
The wall is right behind us, said Pollard, pointing toward the back of his house. I do not think you can get out through here, though. Too many grenzes.
That's what I figured.
Reed tried again to sit up, and this time managed to pull himself upright, though even then he had to rest his head flat against the back of the couch, feeling too weak to support his own weight.
I don't know how I'm going to get out. I just needed somewhere to hide.
You stole that bicycle, said Pollard.
Yes.
It is a girl's bicycle,
said Pollard, nodding sagely.
And your jacket.
The police might be looking for them, said Reed. When I leave again, I can't take them with me.
Pollard frowned.
Surely the jacket will be less familiar than your face.
The police haven't seen my face. Then how were you shot?
Reed didn't answer for a long while, trying to come up with something. Finally, he settled on a version of the truth that seemed to explain things without inculpating himself.
Lisa and I were looking for a message left in secret by an agent we've been working with. We found it and translated it, but then somebody found us. The shot was wild, that's why it hit my foot instead of something vital. Just bad luck that it hit me at all, really. Getting the message back to the West was more important than saving me, so Lisa ran one way and I ran the other. I drew them off and got away.
He couldn't resist adding that last part, assuring the old man of Lisa's safety and of his own heroism, but saw immediately that it was a mistake. Pollard's forehead wrinkled in concern, and he looked at the window again, leaning forward to peek through the gap at the edge of the curtain.
"Are you sure they did not follow you?"
"This was miles away," said Reed. "I promise no one knows where I am."
Pollard didn't look convinced, but he settled back into his chair. He looked at the floor for a moment, then back at the dark curtain.
"Where do you go now? Can your government get you out?"
Reed felt himself deflating inside, his eroding hope starting to crumble in bigger and faster chunks.
"Probably not. It was a very..."
He didn't even know how to finish that sentence. "It was a very illegal mission," he added to himself, "completely unsanctioned by his office or the government, and instead of good intel, it had resulted only in getting me accused of treason." If Lisa had made it back safely, she would already be in Davis's office telling him the entire story. It might be that he could never go back at all.
"I don't know what to do," he said. "You want the truth? I'm not a field agent, I'm a cryptographer."
He reached inside the jacket to the breast pocket of his shirt and pulled out the Mother Goose papers.
"See, this is the kind of stuff I do. Letters and numbers. I'm just a mathematician with delusions of grandeur."
He dropped the papers on the couch next to him.
"I came on this one mission because we needed my one specific skill set, and now everything's gone wrong, and I don't know how I'm ever going to get back home again. Maybe I can't."
"Lisa will find a way," said Pollard. "She was always very good at her job."
Reed nodded, more in resignation than agreement. Lisa being good at her job was part of the whole problem right now. If only he could talk to her again. If only he could talk to Davis. Davis knew he wasn't a traitor, right? Unless Davis was the traitor. And he had used this as a perfect opportunity to frame someone else. Reed thought about it for a moment and wondered if there was anyone in the cabin he could be completely certain wasn't a double agent. Bolreich? Wagner? Frank? Frank was pretending to be a traitor, but that didn't mean he hadn't already been one for real. If he was such a prime candidate for shifting his loyalties, who's to say the Stasi hadn't already turned him? And now Davis had given Frank the perfect cover for passing secrets to the enemy. They'd literally ordered him to do it. The more Reed thought about it, the more he realized that the only person he trusted, the only person he was 100% sure of, was Lisa. If all she'd planned to do was get rid of him, she'd have done it. Why leave him alive? No. It was far more likely that this was all real, that Longshore really was her old partner, Dietrich Boom, that Boom really was trying to warn her about a double agent, that Lisa really had been just as surprised by that message as Reed. If there was anyone in the cabin he could trust, it was her. But how could he get her to trust him?
"Do you have a car?" Reed asked. I'm sorry, I saw a car in your driveway. Can you take me somewhere?"
"Can you walk?" asked Pollard. "There are places in the country where the border is less closely patrolled, but you would have to walk for kilometers even to reach it, and you would have to be very lucky to cross."
"We're not going to the wall," said Reed. "Or I guess we are, but we're not going to cross it. Not today. I'm going to try to send Lisa a message."
"I can loan you some clothes," said Pollard. "Where are we going?"
"To Neukölln," said Reed.
After all, the cabin was barely 10 feet away from the wall there. People talked across it all the time. Why not Reed and Lisa?
Pollard went into the back of the house, the old floor squeaking as he shuffled through the halls, and after a few minutes he returned with a pair of trousers, a button-up shirt, and a pair of boots tall enough to hide the bandage on Reed's foot. Reed changed, gingerly, doing his best to keep his foot from flexing, while Pollard went back into the bedroom a second time. When Reed was dressed, Pollard returned with a coat, a hat, and a cane. Reed accepted them with audible relief, and together they walked out to the car. Pollard was almost as slow on his feet as Reed was, and Reed tried to stop him and give back the cane.
"Please, this is yours. I can't take it."
"Michelle, my wife, would want you to have it," said Pollard, and handed him a bottle of pills. "These also. Two more now, two more tonight, but do not take too many." He smiled. "You will start to see pink elephants."
Reed smiled back, took the bottle, and swallowed two pills dry. The drive was long, south, past the French sector, then through the city center on their way toward Neukölln. But they had only gone a few kilometers toward the center when traffic slowed nearly to a stop. They sat in the car for several minutes, inching forward at a glacial pace, when Pollard finally rolled down his window and shouted a question to a driver who was inching north in the opposite direction. Reed couldn't hear the exchange and waited for Pollard to lean back into the car and roll his window up.
"The American army has stationed a tank division in Friedrichstrasse," said Pollard. "Every soldier and Stasi officer in the city is heading in to respond."
Pollard frowned at the traffic.
He said he thought they might start shooting.
Reed looked at the street ahead, concerned.
"It can't be a real attack. I mean, I can't imagine it would be. We'd have heard something, or they'd be routing cars out of the combat zone."
"Maybe they are," said Pollard.
A few blocks later, they found a police officer waving all the southbound cars onto another road, detouring them away from the city center. Pollard drove in silence, his face solemn, and Reed craned his neck to peer down each new side street, trying to see any signs of fighting. There was no smoke, no sounds of guns or bombs. Were they really fighting or just escalating the showdown? How much further could it escalate before it exploded? It took them over an hour to reach Neukölln, and then they drove down Elsenstrasse toward the wall. They could have driven right up next to it. They could have rammed it if they'd wanted to, but the Grenzers were still watching, and Pollard pulled to a stop about a half a block away.
"Here?"
he asked.
"Here," said Reed.
"Thank you for the ride. Can you wait?"
"I am retired," said Pollard, "and you are trying to stop a war. Do I have anything better to do?"
Reed smiled, gripped the old man's arm, and then stepped out of the car. The experience was surreal. The same neighborhood he saw every day, the same skyline, the same sounds, even some of the same people, but all from the east side of the wall. It was like looking through a mirror, knowing you were trapped on the wrong side of it. He felt unsettled and wrong, like a stranger in his own skin. He walked to the end of the street, leaning heavily on his cane, his foot throbbing with pain. And then there it was, the wall, topped with barbed wire, and beyond it, the tall building that housed the cabin. A similar building faced it from across the wall, like twins, separated at birth. Reed stopped by the corner of the building, watching the cabin's door, wondering if anyone would see him, wondering what he would say if they did. He didn't really have a plan, despite all the time he'd had to come up with one. He looked up at the fifth-floor window, hoping to see someone he knew, and there was Ostertag, leaning on the windowsill and smoking, staring into the park. Even though Reed had hoped to see someone, had expected to see someone, it still shocked him. His friend and co-worker. So close and yet so unreachable. Reed looked around again and spotted a Grenzer,
There was always at least one, this close to the wall, and probably far more. Reed swallowed, steeled his courage, and waited. As soon as the Grenzer looked away, Reed waved to Ostertag, but the man didn't seem to notice. He was probably staring at the yoga girl, Reed realized, and he looked toward the park to see if he could find her. Maybe if he walked up next to her right into Ostertag's field of view, he could get his attention and pass him a message. Reed gritted his teeth and started walking. How could he do it? Ostertag was a cryptographer, so there would be any number of ways to send a message that the men would understand. Morse code, maybe just by moving his hand up and down, or semaphore, which was literally designed to be read by one cryptographer looking at another, but no, that would be too obvious. Everyone in the park would see what he was doing and know that he was sending a message across the border. He had to find a subtler way. But how could you send semaphore subtly so that no one could tell that's what you were doing? And then he saw the yoga girl standing in the park, her legs spread wide and her arms held firmly to the sides, straight out like the arms of a cross. It was a perfect semaphore R. Reed froze, staring at the girl. It couldn't possibly be. Could it? She held the pose for several seconds and then moved to another, the same pose Ostertag had pointed out to Reed before, with her hands and feet on the ground and her backside pointed high in the air. It had seemed so salacious at the time, with Ostertag leering, but now all Reed could see was two arms pointed at downward angles. The semaphore signal for the letter N. He glanced up at the window, but Ostertag wasn't looking at him. He was staring at the girl, and Pollard's borrowed hat, he supposed, made Reed unrecognizable from above. He stepped under a tree just to be sure he stayed hidden and watched the girl move into another pose. Sitting on the ground, right leg pointed out to the side with her body bent over it and her left arm pointed up at an angle. Another yoga pose, probably designed to stretch the lower back, and also, if you looked at the leg as an arm, a perfect semaphore O. She moved into the reverse of the same pose. W. She had just spelled the word now. She balanced on her hands and spread her legs wide, probably a U. Then something he wasn't sure of but could have been an S or a D. Some of the letters were more obvious than others, and in some poses he couldn't tell if he was supposed to pay attention to the arms or the legs. Next came an obvious E. Son of a bitch, whispered Reed. Something are now use. The girl in the park was spelling a clear, readable sentence right under their noses. And Ostertag was the double agent. 10:27 a.m., East Berlin. Reed stepped closer to the trunk of the tree, his eyes wide, his hands trembling as he clutched the cane. What was the full message? She was telling someone to use something, something with an R at the end of it. Baker. Wagner. Kohler. She moved into another pose, what he now knew was an S, and then a C, and then something he couldn't figure out. She squatted on her fingers and toes, looking for all the world like a frog, and then slowly rested her knees on her elbows and lifted her feet off the ground, balancing all her weight on the palms of her hands. Maybe from Ostertag's perspective it looked like something, but Reed couldn't tell what it was. She finished the pose, and as she moved to the next, she glanced at Reed, and he realized he was staring. He turned away immediately, hoping that he looked like just another lecherous man caught staring at a pretty girl in the park. It made him feel disgusting, but it was better than looking like a spy. When he turned, he saw that another Grenzer had arrived, watching the yoga girl just as closely as Reed had been. Another lech, or her Stasi handler. Reed stepped to the left, putting the trunk of the tree between himself and the cop, and saw Pollard walking toward him.
"Morgan," said Pollard, looking like an innocent old man on a walk.
"Morgan,"
said Reed, and then fell into step beside him and whispered, "Walk with me. Pretend like we're talking." Pollard immediately launched into rapid-fire German, describing his morning and his breakfast and his back pain, and Reed pretended to listen while he stole glances at the girl doing semaphore. She spread her legs apart, one straight down and one off at an angle, and then stretched her arms high above her head. If he looked at one arm and one leg, it would be a D. But if he focused on the legs alone, it was an A. He nodded at something Pollard said and watched as the girl broke the pose, shook her limbs a bit, then went back into the same one. Not an A, then. No word had two A's in a row. S-C something D-D. But that didn't make sense either.